Yes, thank you, Luca. So, up to now, I was too serious, and but now let's release the leaks because we will discuss the other type of boundary conditions. So, let me recall that we were studying the conservation of the law or the non-conservation of the presynthetic current while jumping from a codimension one surface to another one. And I was arguing that there exists some boundary conditions that kill the pullback on the boundary of the presynthetic current, meaning that maybe implying the conservation of the precipitating current between these two hypersurfaces. And it leads to a well-defined variational principle in the standard sense. But now let us consider leaky boundary conditions simply by taking the negative of the previous statement. And you see that if you evaluate the presynthetic form on sigma 1 and afterwards on sigma 2, you will have a difference, which will be governed by the pullback of omega to the boundary. And that's, for instance, typical for null boundaries. Hence, for the BMS problem I will discuss at the end of my talk, we will be facing with leaky boundary conditions. Alors, this can also have meaning in ADS, even if the conformal boundary in ADS, so spacetime with negative cosmological constant, is a special infinity in presence of non-trivial gravitational radiation, you can give meaning of that, but it's far away from the topic of my talk. These kind of boundary conditions are also mandatory for boundary conditions set at finite distance boundaries, such like black hole horizon, etc. The important thing is that we can no longer make this beautiful construction in order to render the action stationary on shell. So, guys, we have to live with it. For this kind of boundary conditions, the action principle will not imply the stationarity of the action on shell. And this is not a problem actually, because for leaky boundary conditions, you will be considering here a fluxing system which is exchanging with what is ahead of B. So the first property of the presynthetic current I wanted to discuss. And now let me state the fundamental theorem of covariant phase space formalism. Yes, let me spin one half, yeah.
Sorry, you must take this just because there are people connecting virtually, so they will not be able to hear you, even if you shout.
Thank you. Can you explain a little bit better what omega restricted to b equals zero means? I mean, how do you extract a condition out of that? What does it
Dot
mean?
condition. You can see it in the sense of the pullback. So I pull back this form to the boundary, I get zero. So locally, I can say that theta is exact, delta is exact.
But so what I know is that sometimes you have a the one form that you will one form you say I want it to be zero on B.
Theta,
And that can be either, I don't know, Lagrangian submanifold, or it can be a condition on the fields. So
yes, but it will imply polarization on your phase space, right? For instance, so you want to kill theta instead of omega.
no, I don't know. I'm asking you
You
what
said the Liouville form, so.
So you ask for a Lagrangian submanifold of some space of fields.
Yes.
And that's uniquely determined by that equation?
I'm just asking that the boundary conditions are such that, for instance, the field are decaying sufficiently fast to be.
It's a family of boundary conditions that's satisfying. Okay.
Does it answer to your question?
Or? Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. No. The fundamental theorem. Of the current phase space formalism. So I will be interested at some point to compute the charges. And in classical mechanics, if I have a symplectic form on my phase space, if I contract it with an Hamiltonian vector fields, I will get the exact variation of the Noether charge. And this is the same logic here, because if I contract my presymplectic current with a diffeomorphism, I can show that it is equal to an exact n minus one form when there is two hypotheses, when phi is on shell and delta phi obey the linearized equation of motion around phi. So this is the fundamental result, and this is why I was boring you with all this formalism before. Because here, up to n minus 3 form, which is a surface ambiguity that will be killed when defining the charges, this theorem gives to me this cake psi, which is what I wanted from the beginning. So codimension 2 form that I will be able to integrate on the codimension 2 surface to obtain what is called the surface charges. And, oh, that's nice. You will see the magic of the blackboard. So now, if I contract the presymplectic form itself, I will have that. And using the fundamental theorem, it will give me the integral of on S, which is a codimension two surface, defined as the boundary of Xi of this K Xi, simply by applying again the Stokes theorem. And that will be my definition of what I call the charge. So, to be precise, sigma is a surface here, and it's difficult without colors, but the boundary S is this circle on the figure. So yes, that's it. We have our charges. And this object is, in general, a scalar on the phase space, but a one form on the field space, because it still contains a delta phi. And to be precise, this object represents the variation of the charge between a solution phi and another solution which is infinitesimally related to it. And to get the final charge associated with a phi, for instance, I will need to perform an integration on the solution space. So I will choose a path C from a reference solution phi bar to my target solution phi, and I will have here delta phi to compute this integration, and I will be interested in computing this object. which is the path integration on the phase space of micro dimension to charge, my surface charge here, up to the contribution of the reference solution that I am able to set as an offset of my charge, if you want. We will say that the charge is integrable if this final object is independent on the path C linking phi bar and phi. And otherwise, it will be non-integrable, and we will have some particularity to take into account. Okay? I will not have time to prove this theorem, but I will simply give you the expression of the charge in the Waltz definition of the symplectic form. But before that, I want to mention something important, because this fundamental theorem is also valid for the other choice of presymplectic current, which is the Barnish-Brandt one, and which is also very interesting, because if Waltz one relies on the variational principle, the Barnish-Brandt one only relies on the equation of motion. So it's why it's called the invariant presymplectic current, and it's well suited to be applied also for other type of gauge theories. And the definition is inspired by the first order theories, where this particular current is natural, I would say. If you want more details in a pedagogical level, I refer to the associated part in my thesis or Roman's note for the Modav summer school. But up to this comment, if you try to prove this theorem with the formalism I introduced, so you simply have to contract omega with delta psi phi and seek for a boundary term here. The boundary term you will get will be expressed like that. Okay. Will be expressed like that. So this local n minus 2 form will be something like delta q psi of phi minus q delta psi also of phi minus the contraction, and this is the integral product with respect to the space time. This is an iota, if you want, theta phi delta phi. And these are what is called the higher Waltz charges. In this definition, so q psi is the Noether Waltz charges which verify this property. So it's delta j psi minus delta s psi, where j psi is the Noether current and x psi is the weakly vanishing current. Now there is a problem there. No, sorry. Like this, better. okay, so q psi is a particular realization of a solution of that equation, in fact. And this is given by the following expression, and I will explain a bit more what it is. Where this operator is made for integrating the D. In general relativity, the theta mu, for the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, is given by the following expression. Where delta j is a linearized perturbation around the solution of general relativity. And this operator can be computed as proportional to this ugly expression, but I have to give it to you if you want to do the exercise. And it enjoys the property that I xi d plus dxi is the identity. Hence, if you add with this operator on that definition, you will have something like xi of that difference equal to qxi. But you see that this operator is just acting on derivative of xi, which are absent from j or from s, from a part of j and from s. So the term with s will disappear, and in j you will just have the contribution of theta. That's why you can prove this formula, but I will not give more insight about it here. Hence, if you do the computation, and it is done in full details in Geoffrey Compers and I lecture notes, in my thesis, in Romain's lecture note also, you will obtain this object. So it's a n-2 form, which is simply what you expect for the so-called Komar term. And if you have a Killing isometry somewhere, you compute the charge through this theorem, you will simply have the so-called Komar integrals, which are the contraction of this particular combination of the covariant derivative of your isometry. Okay, sorry, I have no time to prove that these formulas are correct, but for the purpose of that lecture, I kindly ask you to trust me.
I had a question on the... Mm-hmm. Is this IXC unique in the sense of inverting D, or...
It's the interior product.
I think it's supposed to be some sort of homotopy operator in this setup, and usually those aren't unique, right?
It's the integral product of the space-time manifold.
Oh no, sorry, the capital your capital I.
The capital I. Yeah. It's a prescription to give the charge. It's Wald prescription.
It's what?
Sorry. Wald.
Wald.
It's okay. Wald's prescription. It's one operator that satisfies this identity.
Okay, but there's others.
And that returns the Komar charge for Killing isometries. Uh-huh. So it's a choice. It's merely a choice.
Okay.
But in fact, it's a choice. But if you have that property, you can prove that theorem for implying that expression. So giving Q is just a matter on how you define IXI, if you run the proof. Okay? So yes, just one more comment on this formula. In general, when you fix the gauge, you fix your coordinate system, you will have to solve some gauge fixing condition in order to obtain your asymptotic symmetries. Simply look at the definition I gave you before. Hence, in general, your asymptotic symmetries will depend on the fields. And this contribution will be taken into account by this term. So Q delta xi means precisely the Nutter-Wald charge, but not associated with xi, but with a variation of xi, and which is non-zero when the fields are allowed to vary. Okay, so now let us discuss the question of conservation and integrability. I recall you that the presymplectic current is closed on shell, and if you contract the result of this equation on the symmetry, you will have something like that, e delta xi phi omega. I don't remember the sense. Okay, like this. And by definition, this is the contraction of omega on a symmetry. So that's the charge here on S2, which is the boundary of sigma 2. And here I have simply the charge, the same charge, but evaluated at S1. Plus here, something that breaks the conservation of the charge if I have a leaky boundary condition. You see that for conservative boundary conditions, omega is zero on the boundary B. So this term is absent and the charge is conserved as usual. But in presence of leaky boundary conditions, I cannot demand that. And in general, my charges will be not conserved. You see that if I have some field symmetries, such as Keeling symmetries, so delta psi phi is zero, hence this term is zero, so the charges for Keeling isometries are also conserved, are always conserved, sorry. That's a nice property. So it was for conservation. No, non-integrability, so non-integrability means that this object is not a delta exact object, hence, in general, that integral will depend on the particular path you take from the reference solution to the final solution you are interested in. Hence, you will experience non-integrability of the charge on the phase space. And it will come from two origins. The first origin, if you assume that delta xi is zero, to a bit disentangle both, you can see that if you act with delta on the surface charge itself, you will have one term left, which is this one. Because delta xi is zero, so this is zero. This will involve delta square, which is also zero. So I will just have that term contributing. And if I use some properties of the Korean phase space and the definition that omega is delta theta, I will simply have that property. And so again, since S is part of the boundary, for conservative boundary conditions, this object is zero, and the charge are meant to be integral. But in the presence of dynamics at the boundary, so leaky boundary conditions, this term will control, assuming this, will control the non-integrability of your charges. But this is a property from that term. But we have still that term to take into consideration. And now you can have, even in the absence of dynamics, some non-integrability coming from the field dependence of the gauge parameter. I will not be very concrete and very precise on that, but I will just give you one more comment. If you don't expect to have some dynamics at the boundary, so in presence of conservative boundary conditions or in theory with no propagating degrees of freedom like 3D gravity, you will not expect that your charge will be non-integrable as well. And then it's possible to find a good slicing on the phase space or more simply speaking, a good choice of gauge parameter to cure this non-integrability. So it's like a Pfaffian problem on your solution space to find the right set of gauge parameters that will make your charges integrable. But when you have flux through your boundary, so in the presence of leaky boundary conditions, you can do whatever you want. You will never be able to cure this non-integrability. And fortunately, you cannot, because it will contain very interesting physical information. But in that case, you will have to say what is the charge and what is the flux, as I will show you right now. Yes?
So you said that in the presence of leaky boundary conditions, you will never be able to cure the non-integrability problem, right? Is the converse true? In the absence of leaky boundary conditions, can you always cure a problem of integrability that would be there?
It's a strong conjecture, but not yet proven.
All right, thank you.
At least up to my knowledge. There are a lot of examples where it's possible, in fact. where you have no dynamics, when it's in 3D gravity, it's always possible to find the good slicing to cure this non-integrability. But in general, I don't have any proof of that result. Okay, so generally, for non-integrable charges, you will have to prescribe a split between what you will be calling the integrable part and the non-integrable part. And this split will be motivated at some point by a physical prescription. For instance, you will demand that the flux of that guy is zero for a subset of conservative boundary conditions, for instance, for stationary configuration or in absence of gravitational waves or whatever. And in the presence of this non-integrability, the story will be a bit complicated at the level of the charge algebra. So we are moving into the last part of this talk. Because I have no time to show you this property, but it's a fact that the asymptotic symmetries close a subalgebra of the diffeomorphism on your manifold. This algebra is represented on your solution space by this property. So I will just write you one equation. For a particular modified bracket that I have no time to discuss here. And this will represent for you the algebra of asymptotic symmetries. A nice property in classical mechanics is that if you have an algebra of Noether symmetries, you know that your Noether charge will also represent this algebra with the Lie bracket, the Poisson bracket as the Lie bracket. But here, a similar result exists, but only in presence of integrable charges. Hence, if you assume integrability, you will be able to define a Lie bracket among the charges, which is very reminiscent to the Poisson bracket in classical mechanics. Hence, I will also call it Poisson bracket. So that's a definition of the bracket. And you will have, here is the theorem, you will be able to show that this bracket is aimed at representing the symmetry algebra for the charges, but up to a central extension, which is a Lie algebra to cocycle valued in the reals, central extension. So that's the famous representation theorem, which holds, for instance, in 3D gravity, where you consider asymptotically ADS spacetimes. So you have as asymptotic symmetries two copies of the Witt algebra. And the charge algebra will be the two copies of Virasoro algebra with a central charge, which is called the Brown-Eno central charge. But in the absence of integrability, this result has to be modified. Because, again, I have no time to prove it in here. You can find it in the references I gave you at the beginning of my lecture. But the proof heavily relies on the fact that your charges are integrable. So if not, you will have another result, which is the following. So I will write in presence of non-integrability. The procedure will be always the same. So you fix a split. And this split is a definition. So when you fix the split, you have one xi, and it's related to a couple of xi, and a big xi, little xi. You can because this writing is ambiguous, you can change your split, but I will explain you a bit more later about that. And what can be shown, and it has been shown by, it has been discovered in fact by Barnish and Troussard more than 10 years ago, that we can define a modified charge bracket, which is by definition the usual one, and I will not write it like because it will be confusing. No, like it. So you define a modified charge bracket, which is the usual one, plus the contribution of the non-disaggregable part contracted with the other symmetry. And with this bracket, you can show that, and it will be a bit long to write, but I will write it because it's a very marvelous result. You can show that the algebra of asymptotic symmetry will be realized on the charges, but at the price to have a field dependent to cocycle whose general expression is like this. Plus, again, a central extension as usual, which will only depend on the reference solution. I forgot to mention here, but. And this is a Foucault cycle, but now it will depend explicitly on the fields. The nice thing is that this algebra does not depend on the particular split you choose between integrable and non-integrable part. It will only change this this cocycle. And as I will show in a couple of minutes, this algebra controls the non-conservation laws of the non-conserved charge in the presence of leaks at the boundary. And the modifying the bracket is not a mathematical artifact. It's really physical, and it will induce you the flux terms in the charge algebra. But okay, for those among you that don't want to see a field-dependent cocycle in this in this part of the algebra, we can in fact subtract it from the bracket to have a genuine Poisson bracket, as shown by Laurent, Daniele, Simone, etc. Roberto, yes, the last name. And there is a good prescription for that. Okay. Questions? No?
This cocycle term explicitly depends explicitly on the path again, right? There's a C there, the integral.
No. That's a very good comment. No. In fact, assuming no topological obstruction on your field space, you can show that in fact it integrates a closed form. In fact, so it's also exact.
So there is no ambiguity left in the definition of the modified bracket.
No. Up to giving you a particular split.
Are you saying the K term that you wrote down is actually like non-zero? I usually would have expected somehow the central extension somehow just comes from this. The other term you wrote down, the two co-cycle. Like, there's a lot of situations where you can prove you always can eliminate that whole right hand side. Like, do you have an example where this K term actually can't be eliminated with the field dependent co-cycle?
The K term is the central extension. And you can remove it by adjusting your. It's possible, if you find a reference solution for which it's zero, it will work. But apart from that, this cannot be removed or in particular case, but I don't have a particular example in mind, but if you,
I mean, so you, the you example have to, I have in mind is that when you do this on like black hole horizons and you want to try to get like Virasoro charges on a black hole horizon, that central extension term comes from kind of the field dependent piece. And if I wanted to, I could get rid of it.
Yeah, okay. But okay.
But that's what I was asking about. Like here, you've written it in a way that seems like I can't get rid of that K. But there's other examples where the central extension that you're talking about is really the field dependent piece.
In my writing, all the field dependent is here. That's a theorem. Okay?
Yeah, so I'm asking, are there actually examples where the second piece is not zero, the K on the third line?
And you remove it by a field dependent redefinition. That means that you also adjust the integration constant, I would say, of that integral.
Like in the Brown-Hinault case, can you show that the K would be not zero and it's not something that you could remove with the...
Yes. In the Brown-Hinault, you have integrable charges, so that is zero, but you have here an unavoidable central charge. If you perform the analysis in higher dimension, like 4, 5, etc., you will be able to prove that by adjusting the offset, so that piece of the path integral on your field space, you will be able to remove that. But we do not change the field. We do not make any field redefinition. We just choose the offset of the charge.
Okay, anyways, thanks.
Hey.
That's how you go. I'll ask you later.
He's processing, so you can go on. Don't worry.
Okay. Whew, okay. So now let's talk a bit about BMS. Hence, I will be back to my suitable set of coordinates, so where U labels outgoing null rays. R will be the so-called luminosity distance. So when you have an expanding spherical null front, R will be the radius of this null front. And XA are again the angles on this null front, so the angles on the celestial field. And now asymptotic flat space-time will be such that the asymptote to Minkowski for large R. And I will be interested in the class of metric in that coordinate system which look asymptotically like that. So it will take a bit of time to write the metric, but I'm sorry, I have to do that. Ça c'est mieux. OK. Here you see that for larger expansions, you recover the Minkowski metric and you have subleading pieces. So the subleading pieces are many, but I will just describe a couple of them. So here you have the asymptotic shear, whose derivative is precisely what I was calling the Bondinius at the beginning, and which contains information about outgoing gravitational radiation. The M here is at the same place that the mass parameter in Schwarzschild space-time, so it will be called the mass aspect, the Bondi mass aspect. And here you will have the angular momentum aspect appearing in the angular components of the metric. So you see that this these requirements for the coordinates imposed for me four gauge condition, three algebraic ones, and one differential, which I'll rewrite for the purpose of future speaker. And the Einstein equation will imply that the mass and the angular momentum aspect will have some evolution equation along the conformal boundary, which I rewrite very schematically because of the lack of time. So the evolution for the mass aspect will be something like minus 1/8 square of nu plus a total derivative term. And the evolution of the angular momentum aspect will be something like dA, so plus some quadratics in N and C. Now, as I said in the beginning of my talk, the diffeomorphism preserving the gauge condition and the boundary conditions form the BMS group. And these are asymptotic kinetic vectors whose expressions at the boundary are given by simply T, an arbitrary function on the two sphere. Plus here a Lorentz transformation on the sphere. Maybe I will just mention that this diffeomorphism preserves the asymptotic structure I was choosing at the beginning, which is a clock, a foliation, if you wish, and a metric on the orthogonal surfaces in order to allow me to measure angles. I can relax it and simply demand that the volume of these orthogonal pieces are preserved. And this will allow me to have any diffeomorphism that I want on the two sphere, which will be the generalized BMS four group. If I relax even more and I just demand to have a clock, I will have the Weyl BMS group, which will be discussed later, I think, in this conference. Let me also mention that all this construction is also available in EDS spacetimes. And the natural thing to do there is to fix Dirichlet boundary conditions, which will be represented by that, and which will give rise to the good conservative boundary conditions for EDS safety. But in the presence of gravitational radiation, the more suitable boundary conditions will look like that, and they will give rise to the lambda BMS4 group, which in the flat limit will give you the generalized BMS4 group. But anyways, I will skip that. So in the 10 last minutes, I will talk about the charges associated to this diffeomorphism, which can be obtained thanks to the methods I have introduced so far. So I will be interested first in computing the Einstein-Hilbert presymplectic potential. I think I gave the expression to you a bit earlier, in this talk, and you will see that we will be interested in two components: the U components, which is decaying at infinity, and the radial component, which is the most interesting one, and which looks like that at the boundary, NAB delta C, plus a delta exact term, and plus something that will be decaying at infinity. Hence, I will be interested in the value of the vertical derivative of this object along null infinity, which will be given by that. Now, if I consider my solution space and I act with these different morphisms on it, I will be able to prove that these fields vary as follows. I will write this equation also for the purpose of my followers. Merde, ça je peux pas. Si je peux. Okay, so, and any the variation of any B will be obtained by taking a U derivative of all this stuff. I will not write it down explicitly. Hence, if you contract this object with these transformations, and you seek for a boundary term, you will obtain the so-called BMF charges, first computed by Glenn Barnish and Cedric Troussard 10 years ago. And I will write the final expression for you and derive the flux balance law from the algebra. The BMS charges are obtained as so. So there is an integrable piece. So d square omega is the natural measure on the celestial sphere, is 40m. Plus 2 R, A, and A, plus something that contributes to the angular part of the charge. Yes? Plus a non-integrable piece, which will be shown to be important in the following minutes. So F with F is defined by this combination because I have to write a lot of things. So this is the result. So nothing very illuminating for the moment, but the interesting thing is that these charges are not expected to be conserved as soon as we have a non-vanishing presymplectic flux on the boundary, meaning that we have gravitational radiation arriving at the boundary, which is represented in that formalism by NAB different of zero. Here, I simply wrote down the original choice for integrable part, which is one nice choice because the flux associated with that integrable piece is shown to be zero in the absence of gravitational waves. If you want to have some more comments on the very good choice of integrable part, I will refer you to Romain's talk tomorrow, I think, for that discussion. And now is the moment to close the loop and talk again about the Bondi-Masters formula and more generally to talk about non-conservation law of the BMS charges. So as expected, you see that in the presence of radiation at the boundary, so if NAB is different of zero, you will have this non-integrable piece in the charges. I know. I know. So the charge algebra will now be given by the Barnish-Troussard bracket, and you can show that with these asymptotically mean Kurskian boundary conditions, and all my words are important, for those who know very well this topic, this algebra will be represented without central extension. Hence, I will use this result to compute, as in Hamiltonian mechanics, the total time derivative of h psi, which, okay, but you are used now to my notation, h psi is that object, and I will call that t, psi. Big psi, little psi. This notation is very bad, I'm sorry. Writing is good, but speaking about this notation is really awful. So you will have the partial derivative of the charge with respect to time, plus the variation along the clock, and I recall you that the clock is du, of the charge. You can see that here in the charge, the only how you say that? Hey, Fiorucci. Hey, moment. Oops. Hey, Fiorucci. This way. I'm sorry. You will have only an explicit time dependence in the F parameter, so in the diffeomorphism itself. Hence, this term, you can rework it as simply HBMS delta u xi. But delta u xi is simply minus H, the commutator, the Lie bracket, if you want, between the diffeomorphism xi on the boundary and the clock itself. On the other part, you have this theorem, this representation theorem, which I can particularize as follows. So H tau, yes, so the charge associated to the clock. So roughly speaking, it will be the energy. So M on 4 pi j integrated on the sphere. And, but, well, let me, yes. So it will be simply the Barnish-Troussard bracket minus the contribution of xi, because you know that the difference between the usual bracket and the Barnish-Troussard bracket is precisely this non-integrable piece associated with the clock, but contracted now with a symmetry. And you see that here, using this result, this piece cancels this piece. Hence, the non-conservation law can be written beautifully as follows. So collecting the result, d over du, of the BMS charges is equal to minus xi tau, which is the clock, g delta xi g. And in all letters, it's nothing but the contraction of the symplectic form in the boundary. 1/2 n ab delta xi cab. Now let's imagine that tau is the time translation. So it's in particular a BMS vector associated with R naught, not here. Look, R equals to 0 and T equals to 1. Hence, for xi equal to tau, I can simply pick up the what is interesting in the charge, but which will be nothing but the total energy of this of the system at that time. So it's the bondy mass aspect divided by 4 pi j equals to what? This minus 1 of 32 pi j integration of the sphere on NAB, but delta xi CAB for F equal to 1 and R equal to 0 is simply the time derivative of C, which is N. And I will write it here. And this is the Bondi mass loss formula. Hence, I beautifully close the loop because that was my purpose today, to prove you the Bondi mass loss formula from a symmetry principle. So I have defined for you perhaps too much thing, but enough to be understandable and not too much to be pedagogical, at least I hope. Properties of the covariant phase space formalism, enough to compute in a very crude way, I agree, the BMS charges and show that from these charges and the representation theorem, which is a corollary, I would say, of the formalism, we are able to understand at least the most famous flux balance law for the gravitational radiation in asymptotic flat space time. So if there is no more question, I will thank you for your attention during these 2 hours, and I will be happy to discuss with you during your whole conference about all these beautiful features of gravity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Are there questions? Also online, virtually, if you have questions, don't hesitate. There's a question. Céline, can you give the box to Marius?
So, you obtained this through, the process was well based on symmetries, as you said. Mm-hmm. Usually, as far as I can say, well, we reached that equation using Einstein's equations also, equivalently.
Yes, exactly, exactly. You can integrate
exactly
that.
And done there, right?
Sorry?
This is what you have done also.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So yes, thank you, Marius, for putting that out. You can directly see it in Einstein's equation, by the way. But this provides a nice link between symmetries and the non-conservation law, or as you say, Einstein's equation. So it's a particular realization of the fact that symmetries organize the solution space, which is also work in progress, especially at perimeter, to determine the group of symmetries that will give you the whole set of Einstein's equation up to the order you want. Yes.
Very good. Other questions?
Can you say a word about quantization? Like what, you know, what part of that is easy, what part of that is hard? What are the challenges in your view there?
The challenge, I would say, is here, because with traditional stuff, when you have the standard Dirac bracket, you can quantize, I would say, as readily as you are skilled in canonical quantization. But here, since you have a modified bracket, you have features like cocycle, etc., it will, of course, be a bit more complicated, but I'm not an expert on that, so I will leave more experts than I during the conference making more comments on that.
Very good. Questions? Comments? You probably want food now, right?
Yes.
It makes sense. So I propose we thank Adrian again.
Thank you very much.